This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
On this Memorial Day, we are paying tribute to the love of music. A special edition of Sound Ideas, composed of outstanding episodes of What's on Your Turntable, as people share with us their musical passions.
It's an ancient English song, and all these old English songs, a lot of them were very violent and bloody and sexual and kind of taboo in nature in a lot of ways.
We'll hear from Pentangle, Cheap Trick, The Beatles, Alan Stone, and the band Merchandise. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
When Rockford-based Cheap Trick was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year, we turned to our occasional music critic, 17-year-old Bloomington High School junior Bridget Lance. She says her father Doug is the biggest Cheap Trick fan. She knows. Bridget and her father often share their favorite albums with each other on their home turntable. Doug shared his library of Cheap Trick albums with his daughter, who peppered him with questions about his love for the band and his connection with it.
You were roughly 16, 17, you're around my age, when Live at Budokan came out. What was it like? How did it really impact you, and how big was it when it came out?
Well, I would have been slightly older than 17. I think it was their third album, and I had been interested in Cheap Trick starting in 1975, 76, 77. They used to tour around the Midwest quite regularly, and I would watch them every Wednesday in Champaign at a little place called Chances Are. It was fantastic to be that close to a band that you knew was going to make it big. They hadn't made it big yet, but you could tell that they were going to make it.
Did you ever see them other places besides Champaign?
Traveled to Bloomington, as a matter of fact, for Rites of Spring. Cheap Trick played at one of the Rites of Spring, and I remember riding my motorcycle over to see Cheap Trick.
Hey, I'm gonna flip it so I want you to want me.
Sounds good. Let's go.
Yeah.
I want you to want me.
I remember Mom told me she would always listen to that song, you know, when she was down or something like that. And I really like the song because I think I can kind of relate to her with that. What's your interpretation of it?
Well, catchy, and it obviously worked. I mean, I want you to want me. Just what it says. I want you to want me. I want you. I want to be a friend of yours. I want to be desirable to you.
I agree with that, too.
Obviously a great song that still endures. That if you listen to classic rock stations, you will hear it often.
You said that you knew they were going to be big when you saw them play. Why did you think that?
The music, of course, but they had great stage presence. Bunny Carlos was the drummer, and he had the ever-present cigarette in his mouth, and he played drums with these huge drumsticks, and he was just back there banging on the skins. And Robin Zander would be dressed in all white suits, and he was just a very elegant-looking man. And Rick Nielsen would bop around with his guitar, and he had great stage presence, and Tom Peterson playing the bass, and you just knew that this wasn't a every Wednesday night band that you could watch for $2, that they were going somewhere. And one of their biggest things that propelled them, of course Budokan did, but in the early years, Rolling Stone magazine named them the worst rock band of the year. And bad publicity is better than no publicity. Mm-hmm. And that actually kind of propelled them. And they would even say that on stage. And we'd like to thank Rolling Stone for, you know, naming us the worst rock band of the year. And that was kind of comical, but it certainly got them a lot of attention.
It's actually funny because they recently got inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. When I watched their speech, you could tell just how thankful they were for the fans, of course, but also they emphasized the fact that they were from Rockford, Illinois, a very small Midwestern town. What was it like for you when you found out that they were getting inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Absolutely thrilling, and about time. You know, they took to rock and roll, they took a lot of Midwestern values.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's always just a good thing when your favorite band is from where you're from.
Oh,
it makes you have
sure
a sense of pride or something like
yeah
that.
You feel tied into them. I mean, I would say for me personally, probably the other huge band that was local would have been REO Speedwagon, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be able to identify with these two bands that were so close, and you could think, boy, they're not that much different than me. They grew mm-hmm up right in Rockford, Illinois. You want to listen to Surrender?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, let's put that on. Listen to that for a sec. So, Bridget,
mm-hmm,
Mommy's all right, Daddy's all right. What's your interpretation of that? What are they trying to say?
Well, I always found it interesting how he said Mommy's all right, she's just a little weird. And I don't really understand where he's going with that. But I really like the song because I think the lyrics are very catchy and the song's very catchy. And when I see them play it live, you can tell that it really hypes people up and it makes you want to dance and all that. So it's a very enjoyable song to listen to.
Yeah, I'm not sure what my interpretation is. Of course, never give yourself away. Don't give up. Keep fighting.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, Mommy's all right, Daddy's all right.
Mommy's all right.
You know, I didn't know Mommy served in the war. Mid-80s, they actually elicited for the first time outside songwriters. Rick Nielsen wrote most of their songs for them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they called them 80s factory ballads.
Mm-hmm.
And the song that I'm referring to is The Flame.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful song. What do you think of that song?
I have to agree. I think it is a very beautiful song. Yeah, I think it's really pretty and I really do like it. I like the lyrics with it a lot. I think it kind of like speaks to me in a way. So what is your take on that one, Dad?
It's basically about reigniting the flame and
mm-hmm
getting back into each other. And,
mm-hmm,
and again, the catchy part of it is it's such a beautiful song. And,
yeah,
and Robin Zander's voice just comes out so clear.
Yeah,
precise.
He does have a very beautiful voice.
Got a great voice.
Yeah.
Bridget, I enjoy listening to music with you so much. It's
mm-hmm
it's one of the things that we share. We go to concerts together. We
mm-hmm
went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony together. And that gap, you know, that
yeah
gap that is your age and my age, the one thing that keeps us tied together is rock and roll and
mm-hmm
our turntable, because we play music and we listen to it together.
I think that ties a lot of people together. And I think it's a beautiful idea, since you were there when Cheap Trick, when they first came out, and now you're passing it on to a different generation. And in the future, my generation, I will pass it on to
my kids.
Gotta
keep it alive.
And parents who were there when rock and roll was at its height, they're sharing it with their children, and they're going to share it with their children. So in the end, it's going to be a never-ending thing. It's going to go on forever.
It's great fun, and we're not the only parent-child
mm-hmm
that has that relationship. You know, we have many friends who go to Lollapalooza together, and
mm-hmm
they share that, and they share listening to music, and it keeps us together.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Dad, for getting me into music.
Hey, thanks for listening with me. I mean, it's great stuff.
Yeah.
That's Doug Lance of Bloomington sharing his stories about and love of Cheap Trick with his 17-year-old daughter, Bridget. Thanks to Doug and Bridget for sharing the music played on the turntable in their home. Recently, we heard a classic folk artist that's been getting a lot of play.
Hello, this is John Anderson, owner-operator of Reverberation Vinyl, here on Main Street in Bloomington, Illinois, right across from Illinois Wesleyan University, your heady record store. So what's on my turntable at Reverberation Vinyl? The Pentangle. All right, so why the Pentangle? Well, A, the Pentangle were and are one of my favorite groups, a folk rock group from England from the late 60s, early 70s. They're around for about five records. And Bert Jansch, a famous British folk guitarist before and after the Pentangle, he and John Renbourn were the main two guitarists, legendary guitarists in that group, along with Jackie McShee, Terry Cox on drums, and Danny Thompson on bass, one of the greatest groups of all time. And I listen to them all the time, and especially in the month of May, because 47 years ago this week, the Pentangle played a concert right across the street at Illinois Wesleyan University, which has been at the top of my Holy Grail local recordings list for a long, long time. Every year during the month of May, I pester and badger people around town to see if anyone has a copy, if anybody's sitting on a copy, knows someone that recorded it. Yeah, 47 years ago this week in 1970, the Pentangle played across the street. So, 1970, by that time, the Pentangle had done three records, and three of their best, which was the self-titled first album, the second one, a double album called Sweet Child, and the third album, Basket of Light, which is kind of accepted as their quote-unquote classic LP. We'll play a couple songs from that one, because they were touring that record over here in the States at the time, and several songs from the record were most certainly played at Fred Young Fieldhouse at Illinois Wesleyan University on May 11th, 1970. So we'll lead things off today with one of my all-time favorites, Hunting Song. Okay, so if you're like me, you take an interest in local things to some degree. I'm from here, I'm a townie, and bands that have played here and shows that have happened here over the years are of interest to me. So I was always fascinated, especially after I opened the store, that the Pentangle had actually played a concert like directly across the street from where I'm sitting right now. So They said, it seems to me that somehow, some way, the show was recorded. I've found other recordings over the years of the Pentangle from that tour. I've got one right here in front of me from Berkeley in California from 2 weeks after their engagement here at Westland. And this is one of the songs they played, one of their all-time greats, a tune called Like Wake Dirge. That was Like Wake Dirge, which is maybe the first Pentangle song I ever heard, possibly, actually, on a compilation from a long time ago. But that's one of their all-time greats. And the Pentangle, they had a reputation for reshaping old English songs and old English folk music into a modern context with modern instrumentation. And that presentation was done in a very kind of ancient kind of way, even though it has the very reverbed out and echoey vocals. But on some of the other material, you'd have John Renbourn playing a sitar or an electric guitar, which was kind of gasp, you know, sacrilege to old folkies. But, you know, Pentangle had that reputation as a folk rock group, even though there wasn't a lot of rock and roll. It was almost more of a blend of folk and jazz. But they did original material, and they also did a lot of old English folk stuff, which is the next song that we're going to do, a song called Brutentown. Which is, again, one of my all-time favorites, and it's an ancient English song. All these old English songs, a lot of them were very violent and bloody and sexual and kind of taboo in nature in a lot of ways. But this is one from the Sweet Child album, which is, you know, I think it's my favorite Pentangle record, but this is a song from the Sweet Child LP called Brutentown.
In Brutentown there lived a farmer who had two sons and a daughter dear. By day and night they work and drive in to fill their parents' hearts with fear.
So the last tune is a special one, the closest we can get to the Westland show from 1970. And one of the few pieces of evidence I have from the show, my friend Chris unearthed some old newspaper clippings and pantograph, and one in particular is a photo from the Argus, from the Wesleyan newspaper, the Argus. It shows John Renbourn from the Pentangle sitting in the foreground of the photo playing a sitar at this concert, and you see Jackie McShee and Burt Jantz sitting behind him, and it's a grainy black and white photo, but it's really cool. The song they were probably playing at the time at the show is that features a sitar that they were playing live around that time is a song called House Carpenter. My reason for believing this is that the bootleg I mentioned before, this one here from Berkeley, from 2 weeks after the show, they played House Carpenter, and we will air the live version of House Carpenter from that show up next here. But it's kind of cool to have at least some visual evidence that the show did happen. It said they played to a crowd of 200 at Fred Young Fieldhouse, which is a really small number, but an amazing, intimate show in my mind's eye anyway. Possibly someday we can run across a copy. And I should also say, in terms of other legendary local shows that you maybe wouldn't think of or didn't know of, in 1971, Nina Simone, the great Nina Simone, played at Stroud Auditorium at U-High, which was part of a series of concerts that Illinois State was putting on at the time. And my friend Chris Young, once again, we work on this stuff together and nerd out on this stuff together. But that is his all-time Holy Grail show. So if you're sitting on a 1971 Nina Simone tape from Stroud Auditorium or a 1970 Pentangle tape from Fred Young Fieldhouse at Illinois Wesleyan, please come see me, John Anderson, at Reverberation Vinyl. I would love to see or hear anything anyone would have from either one of those shows. So we will close up today with this really cool live version, which is the closest we can get to our fabled show across the street, Pentangle. This is a live version from May of 1970 of The House Carpenter.
I've heard you have to maintain me.
That's a live version of House Carpenter from Pentangle from 1970, recorded just 2 weeks after the group played Illinois Wesleyan's Fred Young Fieldhouse on May 11, 1970. Our thanks to John Anderson at Reverberation Vinyl in Bloomington for sharing the music playing in his store. What's on your turntable? Let us know at WGLT.org or at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're having a special Sound Ideas today. What's on your turntable? GLT's John Norton dropped in on Jared Alcorn of Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal to hear a sound that flashed him back to the 1980s.
So I'm hearing something I have not heard before. Let me see. It's Merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
What's the name of this album?
The album's called The Corpse Wired for Sound.
Okay. What track are we listening to here?
We're listening to track 3, Right Back From the Start, one of my favorite songs on the album.
So who's Merchandise? What's this band all about?
So they're from Tampa, Florida.
Okay.
This is their sixth album. To be honest with you, I haven't followed much of their other albums. I've always heard great things.
Yeah, that's number six. I should probably have heard of them by now.
Yeah.
We're not paying close enough attention here.
I have heard a couple songs from some of their previous ones, not the full albums, but it definitely sounded different to me.
Well, let me ask you this. You know how you like to categorize things. People are like, if you like this, you will like this. So if you like what, you will like Merchandise.
Oh, man. So it definitely grabbed on strong to a couple of my older loves. Things like Psychedelic Furs, Depeche Mode, Jesus and Mary Chain, some Smiths, Echo and the Bunnymen, and definitely Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me era, The Cure.
So brought you back to the 80s a little bit.
A little bit.
Okay.
So this album shows the band bringing it back to the core three members. Out of the six records they have, the first one they've actually recorded in a studio. Everything else has been in their bedrooms and things like that to record. But it was shared between multiple places, Florida, Berlin, and a little bit in New York, and then most of the bigger production stuff was done in Italy. The songs on this one are a lot shorter. The songwriting is a lot stronger, coming from a lyrical point.
Well, I think you were telling me the other day, if I remember right, or you put it on Facebook or something, this is, what, your favorite album of 2016?
Yep.
I mean, but why is that?
I'm sure you've noticed after us doing this quite a bit that I tend to like things that have a slightly, like, sad or dark hints to it. Even though this might be, you know, have like electronic beats and drums and soaring guitars, sometimes the lyrical content is very, I like downers. I'm a big fan of downers. It's just, you know, when
for
people,
for Mr. Positive, that's an interesting.
Yeah, but I feel like raw emotion of having to deal with like pain and suffering, or, I mean, not so much this, but just having to deal with a very strong emotion like that makes for better songwriting. Like, if you write songs all day about how much you love cupcakes, you know, that's great and all, but at the same time, you're going to get more, at least I'm going to listen to you more if you're like, I had a bad day. Oh, yeah, tell me about it. Like, I want to hear about that.
Well, why don't you take us to another track here?
Sure. So this one is track 6, The Shadow of the Truth. This is the one that, man, if you want to talk about Depeche Mode and that Cure thing I was talking about, Woo! This one got me pretty good.
Okay.
This guitar line is just killing me. Oh, so the album's named after a J.G. Ballard short story, and the band has considered this album kind of as a corpse, forever singing in spite of everything. This last track is definitely, every review that I had read and other, like, doing research on it, everybody does agree that this is one of the best songs that they've ever written. It was actually written 10 years ago by the other primary writer, David Vassalotti, and Carson Cox is the other main writer. And so it was written by the other writer, but it definitely takes a different, whole new mold, having someone else sing it for him. And they'd had trouble for 10 years trying to find the right way of recording some of the songs, similar to the last Radiohead record where those songs were really old and they finally found the precise way to do it.
So what track is this we're listening to right now?
This is the track, it's I Will Not Sleep Here. It starts off with this beautiful acoustic guitar, and the song just continues to build and add more instrumentation throughout. Even one of the strongest lines over the entire album, blood is thicker than water, but both can go down the same drain.
Blood is thicker than water, but both can go down the same drain. Blood is thicker than water, but we go down the same drain.
Name of the album is A Corpse Wired for Sound. It's merchandise. And Jared Alcorn at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal is taking us through some of the tracks. You got another one or two on your mind here?
Another one I really like on the album is going to be track 5, which is Lonesome Sound. This is one of the most driving songs on the album. And not to take away from lyrical content or everything, but I definitely feel like this would be a song that I would see in like a dance prom scene from like a John Cusack 80s movie.
I see the boombox above your head right now, Jared. Band is merchandise. The album is A Corpse Wired for Sound. Jared Alcorn at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. Thank you so much for introducing me to a brand new sound here.
Yeah, thanks, John, for letting me do this.
Jared Alcorn of Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal talking with GLT's John Norton about the band Merchandise and their new record.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
In addition to going to record stores, occasionally we ask GLT listeners to tell us what's playing on their turntable or CD players. Our occasional music critic Matthew Mullins checked in again. He said he wanted to make GLT listeners aware of a new soul album by an emerging artist.
In a perfect world, people everywhere. They could. We're listening to the very first track from the new album by Alan Stone. It's called Radius, and we're at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. And with us, our student reviewer, Matthew Mullen from Normal Community West High School. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again, John.
What an interesting pick. Alan Stone, he's somewhat like you. He's from a small town, a relatively young guy.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, he grew up in the church singing and playing guitar as well, and then he moved along, dropped out of college, and became semi-successful, and he's kind of rising, and he just signed to Capitol Records as well. Is the way it is. I'm
just trying to find my way through this. Yeah, just like you, he has an affinity for soul music, which there's a lot of soul on this record.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He seems and appears as a singer-songwriter, but he has a lot of the soul. His biggest influences were Stevie Wonder, as well as Bill Withers, Donny Hathaway were in there as well, and then Sam Cooke as well.
Tell me about how you got to know Alan Stone.
I got kind of turned on to him just by listening around to artists a few years ago. I heard his song, and it had like a million views. It was called Unaware and on YouTube, and then I was like, okay, this guy's really good, and I liked the soul that he put, and he had just an amazing voice, a lot of bass, chest voice that like could just belt out any note, and then this amazing falsetto head voice that was just, that would just blow the audience away. So I heard that song, and then heard The Wind, The Bed I Made, and then his self-titled album Alan Stone, and a couple other tracks off of that, and I just fell in love with this new sound that still remained true to the soul genre. My next favorite track would definitely be Fake Future. It's about this, how our society is changing and how we become so involved and enveloped within technology, and how he's trying to say that decades ago, it wasn't particularly like that and we had more human interaction, and he's saying fake future because it's all about these new technological advances, as some that have helped and many that really have not contributed to our society.
Almost has a little Prince sound to it too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has this real funk driving groove throughout the song. He just attacks that rhythm very hard. And one thing that I like about Alan Stone is that his vocals are very pure. He doesn't really do much editing at all to his vocals. He likes to keep it pure, and he really hits it hard with his voice. He has this kind of growl in his voice, and it really shows throughout the whole album, but definitely in this song, and because he's very passionate about what he's talking about this whole future that he envisions, because we're turning into a society with more technology. Next one I would love to introduce is American Privilege, which is about how Alan Stone has this background of being white and in a world where he was loved by his parents, and then he gives all these examples of child labor and human rights that were being violated, and he's talking about how it's a privilege that he has that he wishes that he didn't, because he can't share it with everyone. And this whole album is not just about his love and his personal experiences, but about a political and social statement, which I thought was very cool. And it has this intro that reminisces of the 70s and the 80s with the hardcore rhythm, as well as the keyboards really shining through on those, as well as a funky bass line throughout it too. Kids saw in my sheets, oh, one stitch in my sleeve. As long as I can buy them both cheap, American privilege is blurring my vision. All right, this next track is one that kind of gets rid of the heavy driving rhythm section and the crazy bass line, and kind of just strips down to Alan Stone's guitar work and the voice. It's and his voice. It starts with this light guitar, and then his smooth vocals, and it's called I Know That I Wasn't Right. I know that I wasn't right. I know that I wasn't right. It's about how basically in the relationship, and he's giving these weak excuses and then telling the girl that I know that I wasn't right, and he constantly repeats it, which I kind of thought was quite important, because it's like this huge statement that he makes, I know that I wasn't right, and he constantly repeats it, and that's the entire chorus, and it's most of the song after that as well. It was a great song because he still has this kind of soul kind of ballad, almost like You and I by Stevie Wonder, but more of his style and modern, and he uses the guitar instead of keyboards, and it's a very relaxing song, and it ends the album, and I think it kind of ends on a good note, because it doesn't just blow the audience away. It kind of just relaxes, and you get to hear not all these instruments at once, but really Alan Stone, the singer-songwriter himself, you know, just his voice, and then as well as the guitar, and carries that throughout the song, and he has these backup vocalists that really provide great harmony, and it's simple, and it's not too complex, and I think it provides the listener with the true sound of the soul that he provides throughout his music. And I know that I was proud.
From the album Radius, it's Alan Stone, I Know That It Wasn't Right, from this great new album, and Matthew Mullins is giving it a good review here at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. Boy, what do you think on a scale of like 1 to 10?
I'd give it a solid 10. It's a great album, and it's refreshing to hear this new music that doesn't follow the normal pop form, and I really think the album's just about the amazing genre of soul, and bringing that back and providing a new sound that Alan Stone has is definitely a great contribution to the society of music that we have now. When I met you 3 months ago,
to myself, man, this ball seems cold. Just cause you're here doesn't mean you're gold. Just cause you're selling doesn't mean I'm sold. Kiss my neck and then you broke my nose. When the fire's off this butterfly nose, I can't find the way your feeling glows. Yeah. Your love is like freezer burn.
That's Normal Community West senior Matthew Mullins talking with GLT's John Norton about the new album Radius by Alan Stone.
Your love is like, your love is like freezer burn.
I'm Charlie Schlenker, and a special show today of What's on Your Turntable, celebrating the music people love and listen to. Last week marked the 50th anniversary of the release of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album. GLT's John Norton made a stop at North Street Records in Uptown to talk with store owner Jeff Wilson, whose love affair for all things Beatles has been burning for more than four decades.
Well, this is an album that a lot of people say, kind of almost like Nirvana changed music in 91 with the release of Nevermind, the Beatles changed it in 67.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing that just a couple years before that they were doing Love Me Do.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it was Lucy in the Sky, and what a mind-blowing album. I can't imagine hearing all those records that you love, and all of a sudden Sgt. Pepper shows up. It had to blow people's minds.
Well, on the 50th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper, let's talk about some interesting quirks maybe about the album cover itself. You want to start with some of the music, maybe?
Well, you know, a lot of people maybe don't realize that the Beatles recorded everything in mono. And when it came time to do a stereo mix, they weren't even present. It was George Martin, Jeff Emmerich, and a guy named Alan Parsons, the tape engineer. When it came time to do that stereo mix, there was no way to duplicate exactly what the Beatles did. You know, for a month, they did over 700 hours worth of recording sessions, getting that mono mix exactly the way they wanted it. And then came time for a stereo mix just for the hi-fi enthusiast, and the mono and stereo mixes are drastically different because there's no way to duplicate it without the Beatles being there and telling them all the nuances. So the mono version has a lot more punch. The stereo version has got a lot more space, but it's really cool that there's the same album is so different.
Did the Beatles as a group care if it was mono or stereo? Did they have a preference?
No, they really, they just, when they first started recording at EMI, that's the way they did it. Everything was mono.
Yeah.
And they just kept doing it because they just were used to doing it that way. And once again, the stereo mixes back in the mid to late 60s were kind of an afterthought. Most teenagers had a mono record player, so the mono records sold a lot better. And not to mention they were a dollar cheaper than stereo records. At one time, Lennon even spoke in an interview about Sgt. Pepper, said you haven't really heard Pepper until you've heard it in mono. The mono mix has everything in your face, whereas in stereo it pans back and forth and it kind of hides stuff. All the special effects and all the you know, the echoes and all the different limitations or limiters and filters and all the things that they did in the studio kind of went out the window when it was a stereo.
Well, let's take it to another track on the album. Do you have a track that you can give us a little tidbit that maybe some of us might not have known how it was recorded, or a little behind-the-scenes take on the song?
You know, I always liked Getting Better. It's a real rocking song. It's one of those things where you can tell John and Paul are writing a song together. It's getting better all the time. It's kind of positive by Paul. It Can't Get Much Worse is a little, acidic from Lennon. It all kind of bounces around like that, you know?
It's getting better, a little better, all the time. I have to admit, it's getting better, since you've been mine.
We've talked about the album cover in the past. Let's cover that a little bit as well. There's so much going on here with all the faces that are on there, all the references to Paul being dead. Can you take us through a little bit of the backstory on that?
You know, they already had artwork. There was an artist group called The Fool, and they're the ones that painted the Apple Boutique building. Anyway, they had an album cover all designed for them, and one of the photographers came up with the idea of, how about if you get a real, you know, artist that's well-known or whatever, so a guy named Peter Blake designed the whole thing. They were a band called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They weren't the Beatles anymore. And all the people on the cover were people that were very important in one way or another, whether they be a comedian or a world leader or a religious figure. At one time, they even wanted Jesus, Hitler, and Gandhi on there, but of course that was vetoed because it was a little too controversial for 1967.
You wouldn't think Jesus would be controversial, though.
Well, the reason that was is because about 6 months before that, Lennon had made the statement, we're bigger than Jesus, and that whole thing exploded, so EMI didn't want to touch that with the 10-foot pole.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go.
Oh, there's Madame Tussaud's wax figures of the Beatles on the cover, and that's the Beatles watching Sgt. Pepper also, you know. Not to mention a lot of people, I don't know if they've heard the death clues about Paul McCartney. You know, there's always this rumor that he died in 1966, and they started putting things on the album covers to allude to his death. And if you look at the front cover of Sgt. Pepper, there's a couple of things that are unusual. The word Beatles is in red, and that's supposed to be Paul's grave. And if you look at the yellow flowers that look like a guitar,
it just says, to the right of the Beatles there, right?
Yeah, it says Paul ? On it, which is kind of unusual. I think it's all coincidence, but it is kind of weird. Right above Paul's head, there's a hand that's kind of blessing him like a religious person would. There's a little car on the doll. The doll's knees, Shirley Temple doll that says, "Welcome to Rolling Stones." Well, the little car on there is supposed to be the Aston Martin that Paul died in. On the back cover, Paul's got his back to the camera.
And he's the only one with his back to the camera.
He's the only one with his back to the camera, and he also appears to be a lot taller than the other Beatles. But one thing about the cover, too, you know, there's all that Death Clue stuff, which I think is bull, but it is kind of weird that all this stuff kind of coincides with it. It's bizarre. I don't believe it, but sometimes I wonder.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door.
Can you give us another little backstory on something about the album we might
not
know about?
The Sgt. Pepper album cover is one of the first album covers to ever print the lyrics. Most records had inner sleeves that advertised other label albums. You know, when you bought a Capitol record, it'd have all the Beach Boys and Nat King Cole records listed on the inside, too, to help plug those albums also. Well, Sgt. Pepper actually had a psychedelic inner sleeve and a poster with cutouts, little pictures and badges and things like that. I'm also really glad that they've reissued all that stuff. You know, since 2009, a lot of the Beatles stuff has been remastered and redone and repressed on vinyl because everybody loves records again. And the fact that you can buy a mono record for about $25 is great, because most mono LPs are way out of print, really expensive. And usually when you find them, they've been played so much that they're not worth buying. The new Sgt. Pepper box set's going to come out, and it's going to have a completely remixed version of the album. George Martin's kid, Giles, has done it. I don't know if it's Giles or Giles. But either way, he's also done a 5.1 mix of it that's going to show up on a DVD in the box set. So it's really kind of like a quadraphonic type version of the album.
Okay. I'm at North Street Records in Uptown Normal. I'm John Norton with Jeff Wilson, the owner of North Street, and our go-to expert on all things Beatles. It's the 50th anniversary of the Sgt. Pepper release, and we're just having fun listening to the album. What's another song you want to talk about here?
Well, maybe we ought to just play Within You, Without You. You know, it's one of the first times George kind of dabbled in Indian music and all the darubas and tablas and all that kind of thing. Really a psychedelic piece of music, you know, let's play that.
So I have a friend who for years has said the Beatles ruined rock and roll. They killed rock and roll, and the Sgt. Pepper album especially.
Everybody's entitled to their opinion, of course. But Sgt. Pepper is one of those records that's so influential, you either love it or you don't. You know, it's like it's so influential and it's such a beautiful record, but at the same time, it really changed music. You know, it was no longer You Really Got Me and I Can't Get No Satisfaction. You had to really kind of, you know, you really had to start thinking about music, and music made you think. You know, it started kind of becoming more important than just a little pop song. It's more of a culture thing, you know.
Who were following the Beatles after this?
Well, you know, even the Rolling Stones started doing records like the Beatles, you know. Satanic Majesty's Request was their psychedelic record, but it wasn't, it just didn't have the same punch as Sgt. Pepper, you know. It just seemed like they were kind of imitating them. But they did the same thing with, you know, Beggar's Banquet. Was kind of a white album, and Let It Bleed and Let It Be, and, you know, there's a lot of comparisons with the Stones.
How about a final thought?
Well, I can't believe it's 50 years old. I can't believe all Beatle records are starting to be 50 years old now, you know. It's like, well, I guess it's almost like the world's classical music, you know, especially Sgt. Pepper, that's so iconic.
Well, Jeff Wilson at North Street Records, it's always a blast playing music with you, but especially when you got Beatles on the turntable.
Well, thanks for having me. Love doing it.
Face before, nobody was really sure if he was on the house floor. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won.
A Day in the Life by the Beatles from the Sgt. Pepper album. It was 50 years ago this iconic album was released in America. Thanks to Jeff Wilson of North Street Records in Uptown Normal for sharing his thoughts on one of his favorite albums. Thanks to John Norton as well for today's show, celebrating what's on your turntable. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal.
Somebody spoke and I went into a dream.